This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 102nd in a series of interviews with security gurus and others. And I'm super pleased to have with me today Richard Danzig. Hi, Richard.
Hi, I'm so sorry I couldn't be the 100th.
The 100th was a video, too. It was an interesting one. The Honorable Richard Danzig is a board member at the Center for New American Security, vice chair of the Board of Trustees at RAND, a member of the Defense Policy Board and the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, and director of Saffron Hill Ventures. Richard served as the 71st Secretary of the Navy under President Clinton. He's a lawyer who's practiced in Washington, D.C. and taught at both Stanford and Harvard. He also served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, work for which he earned the Defense Distinguished Public Service Award. Danzig has a B.A. from Reed College, a J.D. from Yale, and a Ph.D. from Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. Richard lives in D.C. with his wife, Andrea. His two grown children live elsewhere. Richard recently published a report on computer security, which we will focus on during this interview. So thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
I kind of want to set context first so people know where we're coming from, and then turn to computer security, which most listeners of Silver Bullet are into. So your career is really incredible. I want to spend a couple minutes asking you about some ancient history. When you first went to the DOD as part of the Office of the Secretary of Defense in 1977, you'd been teaching law at Harvard and Stanford. What did you know about D.C. and policy and the interaction of government and the military?
I think probably the most concise answer would be nothing. As a law professor, had a substantial interest in the workings of police departments and prisons, and had taught a course, pretty untraditional for lawyers, on ways of trying to influence and improve those institutions other than classic litigation. And that had gotten me interested in management kinds of issues, and I began to want to see if I could test my own management skills. The Pentagon was the archetypal place to do that, the archetypal bureaucracy. I didn't want to work as a lawyer. I wanted to work as a manager. I contacted some people I knew and eventually persuaded them to hire me as a deputy assistant secretary.
And so what surprised you the most about that job when you first started doing it?
Partly, I think, the talent of the people. I came out of, as you say, the Harvard Law School mode, where I was a visitor at a wonderful institution at Harvard called the Society of Fellows, and was characteristically sort of impressed with the articulateness and smartness of so many people on the Harvard faculty. I came to the conclusion, after I'd been at the Pentagon for some months, that I could pick a team of Army generals who could out-argue and outthink a typical team of Harvard faculty.
But they're better armed. That's not really a fair conflict.
It was, though, quite impressive to me that they had the Army generals, this range of experience and activity and skill. But even in the relatively narrow one of the academics, they could compete quite successfully. Hmm. I think the second thing was, and just I'll limit myself to this, but was the solidarity of the experience. Academia is essentially an individual enterprise. Occasionally you collaborate, as you've done on one of your books, or more of them. But the tendency is you do your own thing, whereas in the bureaucratic and government world, you never really do your own thing. It's like the difference between being a tap dancer and being in a line of rockettes. You've got to get the whole line to move if you really want to accomplish anything. And if you start just doing your own individual idiosyncratic thing, all you do is mess up the chorus of everybody. So it's a very different kind of skill, but congenial in the psychological warmth that ensues.
Interesting. So to move on from there, together with a guy named Richard Sanson. Is that how you say Richard? Peter Sanson. Is that how you say
Peter? Peter Zanton, right.
Zanton, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. You wrote a book called National Service, What Would It Mean?
Right.
While you're vice chair of the International Human Rights Law Group. The book's been credited with shaping America's current civilian national service system. So tell us about the key ideas in that book and kind of relate them to the computer security situation today, if you could.
Well, first, the issue in the book that led me to write the book with Peter Zanton was there's this abstract notion that had a lot of appeal, continues to have a lot of appeal, which is that perhaps all young people or people of different ages ought to devote some period of time, call it a year or two, to public service. And that idea is, I think, very evocative across the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. But no one had at that point done a very good job of trying to reduce it to concrete particulars and analyze the alternatives and therefore give policymakers some realistic models for achieving that goal, mm-hmm. or those goals, which also would show the costs and benefits associated with them. So the book was an effort to instantiate an abstraction, to breathe life into the idea. I think the analogy in the cyber world is that when I came to write the paper you mentioned in the introduction, from my standpoint, a lot of it was just trying to think through for myself what cybersecurity defense meant, but to try and bring home the particulars, not just the abstraction, to policymakers who may not focus at such a rich level of detail or understanding of the particulars. And my general belief, manifest in both those works, has been that getting a sense of the particulars is imperative to being able to make decisions about the general.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And there is sort of a huge disconnect between policymakers and what you called the bits and bytes guys.
And
I think that getting across that chasm is the key. One other thing about your past and how it informs the current set of work. So as Secretary of the Navy, you emphasize people first, transforming a view of personnel from conscripts to skilled workers, and you also took on the rapidly advancing IT field. What lessons from the Navy years can be applied to the problem of computer security, and especially when it comes to the workforce?
Well, first off, just at the eve of taking over as Navy Secretary in 1998, I wrote an op-ed piece which appeared in the New York Times, and trying to suggest something about the new directions that the technologies were taking us in terms of national security. And any Pentagon piece that aspires to be fundamental and adopted needs to make up its own acronym. So I knew that I needed a new acronym, and I decided that acronym should be the word NEW, N-E-W. Uh-huh. And that stood for non-explosive weaponry. And my basic proposition was much of the new technologies, my main examples were the biology and the cyber, were not explosive, kinetic in the traditional sense, but that those who would be concerned about warfare, like our admirals and our generals, needed to develop some expertise in these areas. So this issue interested me considerably, but as Navy Secretary, for a variety of reasons, my focus was substantially in other areas. And as you say, one of these was a fundamental problem for the Navy, which had a large number of empty billets and which continued to recruit people on the kinds of models that had been put in place in the conscription era, because the draft was driving so many people into the Army. The Navy could essentially get free volunteers, keep them for a couple of years at very low wages, and then flush them out. And that produced all kinds of distortions in the Navy system as we moved to a world in the 1990s where we wanted to keep people longer, where people were very expensive, and where, therefore, trade-offs between capital and labor looked very different, and it made a lot more sense to invest in the training and well-being of our people, which also played to the central proposition that I think rightly animates the Navy, which is that people were our most important asset. In the cyber world also, I think a lot of our challenge is recruiting and retaining the right kind of talent in the federal government. I think in the cyber world, the very high quality, uniquely talented subset of people at the tail of the bell-shaped curve are some of the people you most want to attract. But the federal government isn't well situated to attract and retain those people. It recruits according to traditional credentials, which are not very relevant in the cyber world. It retains through very slow, steady accretion. It trains through formal processes and undervalues the OJT. It doesn't pay enough attention to peer relationships. So those are all some of the kinds of things that I think should be on the manpower agenda in the cyber world and that I urge in this paper.
Mm-hmm. That's good. So let's turn to the paper. The title of the report, which was published in July of 2014, is Surviving on a Diet of Poisoned Fruit, Reducing the National Security Risks of America's Cyber Dependencies. To assemble this report, you had to start from scratch, getting your head around this rapidly expanding computer security field. What surprised you the most about computer security that you wouldn't have anticipated before you started?
Well, I mentioned that I had done this newspaper op-ed on the subject of new weapons, and biology was one of them, as well as cyber. I had previously spent a fair amount of time invested in trying to think through the area of bioterrorism and biowarfare, mm-hmm. and what various propositions meant and how we ought to respond and prepare for them, as well as the kinds of natural challenges we're seeing in things like the present Ebola epidemic. And my technique for kind of getting educated in this arena was to go talk to a substantial number of people, ask them about each other, draw my own impressions, and arrive at a conclusion about who I could rely on as a group of 20 to 30 people who I could repeatedly go back to and test propositions with. And I knew as a general rule that if three of them were agreed that something was right, that I could believe it was right.
Only three agreed, out of 20?
Well, I didn't try all 20 on all propositions, but if I took some sample of three who were the most relevant and they agreed, then I could take it as true, and if they thought it was false, I could take it as false. If they had different views, I knew that it was interesting, that, and I'd pursue it further. In the cyber world, I did basically the same thing, and I was very struck with the warmth and generosity and openness of many of the people I spoke to, including this guy in Virginia, Gary McCraw, is probably familiar to listeners.
Never heard of him.
Right. Well, you can deny any role in this. What was striking to me was that, unlike the biology, I would have occasions in which I would go to three relevant people. They'd all agree something was true, and 6 months or a year later, I would come to the conclusion that it wasn't true. And this just didn't happen to me in the biology. So why was that?
Can you give a concrete example of that hilarious happenstance?
Yeah. For example, in the early part of my work, if I talked to people about DDoS attacks, they tended with some universality to dismiss their significance. They cause some interruptions, but they're not commercially cumulative in very substantial ways, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
What I realized happened later was, first, that the field was changing so quickly that people might draw conclusions from the nature of the world a year ago, but they might not, but the world a year from now might be very different.
Mm-hmm.
A second factor is the biology basically was a science. The cyber world isn't, and the effect of that was that there was more consistency in the bio world of understanding, more peer review, more of an understanding of how you integrated new knowledge and where the boundaries and the borders were. You also had greater clarity about training and credentialing. So all those things and then I suppose I should also mention, because I think the biology was a science, though it certainly had its silos, its narrow areas of understanding from some experts, there was a kind of a broad consistency in cross-training and cross-awareness, so that even though an infectious disease doc and an epidemiologist might think and approach problems very differently, they had a kind of shared understanding.
Right.
Whereas in the cyber world, I just don't think that's true. There's much more diversity, many more silos, less common data, less a basis of science. So it makes it harder to work in it.
Yeah, and you know, it actually leads to a real sense of creativity in the discipline because people have such incredibly diverse backgrounds. This is a point that Dan Geer has made, and myself and others. The diverse backgrounds come together with very different points of view and help to make the field creative and move as fast as it's moving. So
I think that's right.
So though,
also, it's newer.
Yeah, so it's newer and it's moving faster, which makes it more difficult to wrap your hands around, and it certainly is not the same as a scientific discipline like biology. I'm with you on all that stuff. Who did you talk to, generally speaking, that you found useful when you were doing this work?
Well, in the acknowledgments in the paper, I enumerate the people who I was particularly grateful to. I tried to get people, and this is sort of part of my method, but I think would be of most anybody's who thought about the problem, tried to get people from very diverse perspectives. So, for example, you mentioned Dan Geer. Dan's kind of very much a free thinker, and though associated with the government at InQtel, not really have a government perspective. But in government, a guy like Andy Osment, who was on the National Security Council and now does infrastructure at DHS, gave me a very kind of complimentary point of view.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, people who had some very different industry experiences could be particularly helpful to me. So, for example, John Stewart at Cisco, or a whole batch of people at Microsoft, or I spent time with some of the entities like Mandiant that very generously helped me. And then I wanted to talk to some big companies. Boeing was particularly helpful to me, and a number of enterprises that had very different angles on this. And then there were some academic experts who were particularly helpful to me. Ross Anderson, for example, at in Cambridge, UK. And as suggested by Ross, I also valued getting some foreign experiences. Another foreigner, Ralph Langner, who has, as you know, a consulting firm in Munich and has worked a lot on SCADA systems, comes to mind. So I tried to really create for myself a reference group that was very broadly ranged but very consistently high quality.
Right. And what myth of computer security requires the most vigorous debunking, in your now studied opinion?
Well, I think other people's studied opinions are worth more than mine, but my focus, the one thing that I could bring to this was a policymaker's perspective. As you say, I'd been in the policy world, and hopefully it had progressed from my 1977 days of knowing nothing to my 2014 days of having some familiarity with how policymakers approach problems like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a tendency in the policy world to make several kinds of errors that my paper tries to contribute to countering. And those are the myths that concern me the most. One is an intuition that the problem is technological, that if only the people who had constructed the internet or other aspects of our digital world had not been infected with a 1960s hippie psychology, they would have really technically gotten this right and paid more attention to security.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think it was the survivability of a nuclear war that drove it the most.
Yeah, but that's all passed, you know, nothing. The reason I called the paper Surviving on a Diet of Poisoned Fruit was that I wanted to find a metaphor to bring home that there's no world in which we can take a Luddite view about digital technologies, turn the clock back. But what we can do is recognize that with their benefits intrinsic to the technology come various costs and sacrifices, and that that needs to be, and vulnerabilities, both in the technical sense of that word, but also in the layman's sense. So getting policymakers to understand that they need to embrace this technology, but they should do so very conscious of its risks, and those risks are inherent, is a first major kind of proposition.
Right.
I think a second is a tendency to treat it as a unitary problem that is defined by its technology, and to undervalue the degree to which cyber problems are intertwined with economic problems, business processes, physical processes, as for example on the power grid, and also the operational kinds of issues of everyday kind of business, and as a result they're variegated, and the problems of a Pentagon organization, a power company, and a finance company, and their abilities to cope with their problems are just radically different.
Yep.
That argues then in policy prescriptive terms for disaggregation of the problem rather than a vision of, well, I'll create a cyber czar and issue general edicts that will address this situation.
Right. I actually think that that latter view is very common in the DoD, where the command and control structure is exceedingly clear. Couldn't be clearer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But much more difficult when you get into the private sector and it's not really clear who's in charge of, say, you know, creating power for the world. Electric power, that is.
I think, though, Gary, that the propensity is to think that if we could have a command and control structure with the clarity of the military hierarchy in the civilian world, then we could address all this better. Mm-hmm. And though there would be some gains, I think, in fact, attempting to address it in some centralized way is not the right route to go.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I don't even think you can run that counterfactual in a meaningful way, though, because mm-hmm. the part after the if, just it's not possible.
That's right. But the question would be, what are you striving to do, recognizing you won't fully attain it?
Mm-hmm.
And if your model is cyber czar consistency, you produce one set of policy initiatives, and if your model is disaggregate, let the people who are concerned with various industries, for example, in their everyday roles, also take on responsibility of the cyber world. They'll need to be augmented and educated, but it's better to have the Department of Energy people concerned with cyber in that context, energy companies, and the Treasury people concerned with cyber and the finance companies, than it is to create some outward-looking entity that does it all.
Right, right. I understand. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So let's talk about the 8 recommendations that you put in the report very, very briefly. I'll let you just sort of riff on those 8 recommendations in any way that you see fit, with an eye towards having people actually go download the report, which is free, and reading it for themselves.
Well, I'd be delighted if people download this from the Center for New American Security website, because because, as I've suggested, part of the richness is in the detail of the discussion. This is a paper with 180-something footnotes because I was concerned to try and not only have a high-level discussion in the text, but also a rich discussion in the subtext about just what's true and what isn't in the cyber world. But the first recommendation is, I think, the most sweeping and central, and says, let's attend to, let's recognize that there's this intertwining of gains from cyber digital systems, but also increased vulnerabilities. And if that's intrinsically rooted in the systems for reasons that I articulate, complexity, communicativity, the ability to, or the inclination, plasticity of the system, disintermediation, the removal of human intervention and the like. If vulnerability comes from all those kinds of things, then on systems we really care about, like our nuclear command control systems, we need to think about how to limit our digital exposures or complement them and interlace them with out-of-band systems or analog systems or man-in-the-loop. And the recommendation tries to lay out how to think about that problem and push our federal systems towards that.
Mm-hmm.
A second recommendation says, if we think that's true of critical federal government systems, we also need to review the extent to which it's true of some non-federal systems. I'm not a fan of federal government regulation to avoid all cyber attacks and the like, but from a cybersecurity perspective, I just need to recognize that there is a phenomenon of akin to the banking industry phenomenon of too big to fail.
Right.
There are some areas that we really need to attend to. I suggest in the paper a national security standard that says, in essence, we ought to recognize that though many people talk about our security problems as in the cyber realm as, does something pose an existential threat for the United States? I think really the issue should be a different one, which is a deterrent one. I think most of our opponents, particularly those who could muster the sophistication for major, broad cyber attacks, are not so likely to be vandals just trying to hurt us as they would be foreign actors who were trying to influence us, mm-hmm. to cause us not to come to the aid of some country or not to intervene in some situation or not to act somewhere. And we ought to think about our cyber vulnerabilities in terms of identifying which are the ones, if any, that would be so grave that if another country could threaten to do this to us, it would deter us from acting to protect our otherwise vital interests.
Mm-hmm.
And that shifts the focus. I'll just give one more example from the recommendations, although I'm happy to go on as long as you'd like on any particular one.
No, that's good. We're good.
Are you good for one more?
Yeah, absolutely.
I suggest that we ought to rethink our interaction with the Chinese and the Russians in regard to cyber issues, not because I'm critical of what's happening. I don't really take a position on issues like the indictments of five PLA members in Pittsburgh District Court. I instead really am focused on, throughout the paper, on what is it that we're not doing that we should be doing. And my proposition in this context is that we ought to be raising with the Chinese and the Russians the fact that there are some areas of cyber risk that we should have a common view about and where we have very strong mutuality of interest. For example, I've mentioned the protection of our nuclear arsenals. It is the case, I think, that it doesn't help either us or the Chinese, for example, or the Russians, if we undertake cyber intrusions of each other's nuclear arsenals. Our present theories of deterrence rest on the notion that it's fundamentally in everybody's interest for each nuclear power to retain a second strike capability,
mm-hmm.
that you are less likely to produce nuclear Armageddon by having a first strike hair trigger. If you know that if someone attacked you, you'd still have a second strike capability
right.
that survived. And but if our nuclear arsenals rest on a cyber foundation and that cyber foundation is vulnerable, then to the extent that we invade the Chinese systems and undermine their sense of security in those systems, we actually reduce our own security by making the Chinese more hair trigger.
Right.
The same thing is true vice versa.
Right.
So that's an example of a different arena of discussion that I'd like to encourage.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think you put it pithily in the paper as mad versus mud, which I thought was pretty clever.
Yeah, good. Glad you liked it. It shows, again, the power of acronyms. MUD, for those who haven't read the paper, is, well, MAD is mutually assured destruction, this theory that we can be assured that if either attacks the other would destroy the first one. MUD is mutually unassured destruction, and my suggestion is, befitting the metaphor, that MUD is much less stable than MAD.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So
this, by the way, of course, achieves the Washington desire in all matters, which is to throw mud at other people.
Oh, boy. So let's get meta on top of this paper. Do you believe this work is going to have a real impact in policy land? Do you have some evidence of that already? And how do you think that sort of thing unfolds? Does it take decades?
Well, let me answer the second first. My general view is that it's when you write papers like this, it's a little like Johnny Appleseed. You throw the seeds out there and you don't really know where they'll grow.
Mm-hmm.
They may flower in some places and lie fallow in others. And in my view, there's just a high degree of unpredictability about that. To switch metaphors to a more modern cultural one, it's a little like Field of Dreams. You lay it out, the field, and you hope people will come and play, and you'll shape the discussion. I think in the biology, I managed to be pretty influential, and that gives me some hope that we'll achieve the same thing in the cyber arena. Of course, there are a large number of other people doing good things in this arena, and one of the characteristics of that Appleseed kind of metaphor is that you never really know whose seed it is that's growing up or who helps whom. I do think the federal government, quite independent of my work, has was getting better before I wrote this thing. I'm hopeful that I've presented in one place in a text that's some 25 to 30 pages long, something that policymakers can read in one sitting and come out with both a better descriptive sense of an analytic sense of what the problem is, and at the same time, some prescriptive ideas, of which we've touched on a few, about what they ought to do. And if it achieves that, I'd be quite happy.
Mm-hmm. Super. So most of the listeners to this podcast are security geeks and practitioners. What should those people do, our listeners, to impact computer security at a national and international policy level?
Well, I think it's hugely helpful if we can cross the boundary between, as you observed earlier, the policymakers and the tech types. So that puts a heavy burden on both. It requires the policy types to learn enough about the technology to be reasonably conversant with it and to at least understand it as well as they understand issues about carrier battle groups when we deploy them. And at the same time, it requires the technology types to understand the policy world well enough that they can interact with it and not simply say, well, here's the technology, you figure out what it all means.
Right.
And so the paper tries to cross this boundary, having lived in the policy world myself, but benefited so much from some of the people who we've described in this conversation. And if it yields benefits to technology readers, it will be first in their seeing how technology points are connected to policy recommendations, and second, providing hopefully some kind of model for them to do hopefully a yet better job.
Mm-hmm. I like that. So last question, which has nothing to do with any of this. So I've really enjoyed getting to know you in the process of thinking about cybersecurity together, spending time walking by the river and analyzing high art and now reading I, Claudius.
Good for you.
So thanks for that. I wanted to ask you, as a person who's very interested in art, what's your favorite picture and why?
Well, my daughter, when she was in second grade, when I asked her about her best friend, said, "I don't put my friends in order."
Very clever. So you're using the second grade defense, are you?
Yes, exactly. Although I hope sometime to upgrade to a first grade defense. I suppose if I had to pick a picture that maybe your audience is not quite so familiar with, I would take Tintoretto's Crucifixion, which sits on the walls of the Scuola Grande di San Rocco in Venice, Italy, and is hard to capture for anybody who's not been to Venice because it's huge and occupies a wall, but it seems to me to compete with the Sistine ceiling, so I would urge everybody to get to Venice and go see it.
Is it the light that does it for you?
It's the drama, the psychological reconception of this act that we all are so familiarized with. But he picks the moment at which the cross is being raised, so it's not fully standing up there, and the ropes are pulling it up, and Christ is being heaved towards his death and towards the heavens. And then all around are all the earthly things of the soldiers playing dice, etc. And it's phenomenally well conceived and well painted. And yet I would have thought from much of the Tintoretto I had seen before then, which is smaller traveling kinds of stuff, that it wouldn't, I wouldn't have thought that Tintoretto would be so evocative for me. But right. Here he is.
Very interesting. Well, thanks. Thanks for your time.
A pleasure. Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August 2014 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on surveillance, which includes editorial by Susan Landau. The issue also includes our conversation with Nate Fick, CEO of Endgame. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.